Isn't that happening right now in our house?
This is The Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 317 for the week of August 24th, 2020. I am Fancy Pants Production David T. Cole, and I'm here with last and final Sarah D. Bunting.
It's the broker's fees that'll kill ya.
Pea stick crafter Tara Ariano.
Do you like the sequins?
And devious licensed real estate agent Brandon.
Always be killing.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us for the first time is Brandon. Hello, Brandon.
Hello.
Brandon.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yay! Thrilled to have you here to talk about Ruthless Realtor, this weekend's Lifetime movie premiere. Here is the premise. In a nutshell, Ralph and Annie Savage, played by a couple of nobodies, unlike on a Hallmark movie, these are nobody you've ever seen before, are on vacation when Ralph spots a realtor putting up an open house sign in front of an absurdly gigantic house and convinces Annie they should look at it. They're not put off by the realtor, Meg, played by another nobody, and her awkward oversharing about her loneliness, and they buy the place, which we learn is close enough to LA where they formerly lived that Annie can still commute, so cool vacation. But anyway, they move in. Meg keeps coming around, creeping them out with her general weirdness even before she hits on Ralph. So when they get a prowler, they're pretty sure it's Meg. But is it? Brandon, I had been following you on Twitter for a while before I noticed you tweeting about Lifetime movies and made a note that we had to get you on this podcast to talk about one. So we have previously covered one Christmas/Hanukkah movie last year. Sarah and I have talked about the unauthorized 90210 Lifetime movie on our sister podcast, but we've never really touched the crimey ones on Extra Hot Great before today. So we're grateful to have your expertise to guide us through this discussion. What is it about Lifetime movies that originally attracted your interest, and what has kept you coming back?
Well, I just want to say I'm always glad to talk about Lifetime movies at any time. So if you just want me on to talk about Lifetime movies, or if you just want to DM me about Lifetime movies, I'm more than happy to facilitate that. Like, for me, I think I, like many people, are aware of the Hallmark movies, mostly just like Christmas time romantic comedies with people in, you know, green and red sweaters, and one part of the couple leaves their job in Manhattan to go back to a small town to, like, you know, be the DJ at a local radio station, blah, blah, blah. And they, you know, that's the plot of all of them. They're always, like, leaving their high-powered attorney job or to go be the accountant at the local blank, and then that's where they find real love and revitalize the town. It's the same plot every time.
Yeah.
Lifetime movies, I think, at least modern ones, are more typically what I would call, like, thrillers. Like, they're thrillers. Yeah. Sometimes they border on horror insofar that, you know, you can have suburban horror that's not, like, you know, slasher movies. But what gets me is that, like, they are thrillers, but they're thrillers aimed at a very, very specific audience, a very, very specific slice of Americana. And the things that terrify them, like, you know, ruthless realtors or like the housing market or like, you know, babysitters who are also, I don't know, human traffickers, are just so foreign to, like, my experiences. And I would say the experiences of probably everyone on this podcast in terms of what they are afraid of and what they think every other people in the world are afraid of. That they come across as almost as you're watching movies from a different country or a different time.
Yeah.
And so, like, it's I would like to say that it is, you know, a sociological interest or like an academic one.
Sure.
But that's really just, you know, gussying it up. Like, they're funny. They're fun. They're interesting. They have twists. Mm-hmm. It's just that, you know, for me, they don't draw on that, like, the cultural terror that I know that they embody for their target audience.
It's like the movie Pleasantville. It would be like the horror movies in that universe, right? It's very Leave It to Beaver-esque continuum from the nuclear 50s white people problems. Like, oh no, the real estate agent is evil. Like
Or is she?
Dun, dun, dun.
Right.
The invasive brisket. Dun, dun, dun.
So, Brandon, you also mentioned in DMs that Lifetime movies have evolved a lot over the past 10 years. How so?
broadly speaking, over the past, let's say, 30 years, you've seen kind of, I want to say, an evolution from the, you know, late 80s, early 90s, sort of like after school special Lifetime movies, like drinking's going to ruin your life, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if you let your daughter go to college, you know, she's going to have one shot of vodka at a frat party and she's going to drop out.
Or turn into a call girl. Yes.
Exactly. A lot of Party Never Stops, right? That's a real movie. It's called The Party Never Stops. And it's a very popular one. Or, you know, if your child ever has sex or if they ever look at internet porn, they're going to become a porn addict. It's going to ruin their life. They're going to lose their scholarship, you know, a la Cyber Seduction, you know, like these are real things. Or they were kind of like, I want to say, steamy housewife, romantic, kind of bordering on like Harley Quinn romances, where it's like, oh, this unappreciated housewife is caught up in this affair with either another man or another woman or something like that. But, you know, they tended to be in those two broad categories with some overlap. In terms of like, you know, housewife is in a domestic violence situation, stuff like that, you know, but more, they were, I wouldn't say more earnest and a little bit more grounded. If grounded, I would say, in the anxieties of the time, which seemed more realistic as they were, you know, emerging technologies or like drinking, sort of like they're the through line there. People have always been worried about their kids, you know, drinking too much at parties.
Yeah.
Now, you know, And so like that was kind of the trend for a little bit. And that's when you see a lot in the 90s famous ones about teen pregnancy, like 15 and pregnant with Kirsten Dunst, HIV and AIDS and other sort of STDs with what's the one? Oh, there's Girl Positive. There's She's Too Young. There's the Pregnancy Pact, stuff like that. And then, but now, and of course, you know, throughout the years, they've always drawn upon very specific, very weird, like moral panics that were happening at the time, like the Pregnancy Pact, which was a big sort of a semi-big sort of thing parents were worried about in I want to say 2000s. You might remember that.
Oh, I watched that.
But nowadays, I say all to say this. Nowadays, in like the, I want to say starting from like 2015 onwards, they've become a little bit more like action-y and thrillery and almost like the housewife version of the suburban housewife version of Taken movies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So like a lot of it has to do with, you know, human trafficking or like my daughter's been kidnapped or my daughter's been, you know, my babysitter is trying to kill me or something like that, right? So they're still like, they're still obviously targeting the same audience, but they've kind of amped up the action. And I would even say like removed some of the more extraneous elements of realism that were unnecessary for the enjoyment of it. Everything's a little bit like realer and slicker. What I would say though, is that, you know, one thing you will notice about the idea that these are thriller movies aimed at the anxieties of like suburban housewives is that there are just certain things that movies aren't really about, which I mean, these movies are never really about, like, which you would imagine would be actual things kids would be into, like, you know, not into, but happening to them, like struggling with their sexuality. Mm-hmm. Or racism, or interracial dating in some broad sense of the word, or like school, like, you know, school violence in terms of like school shooting and stuff like that. The kind of more like, I would say, grounded, like real scary things that kids are kind of worrying about, you never really see. It's mostly just like moral panic type stuff, like, oh, my kid's choking themselves to get high and they're going to end up with like brain damage.
Hearing that sort of distilled short history of the format really makes me sad that the Lifetime formula wasn't around during my formative years. Like, I would have loved this production value, everything that goes into a Lifetime movie about the Dungeons and Dragons scare of the 80s,
yes,
which gives me an idea.
God, yeah.
Retro topic Lifetime movie series.
Oh, yeah.
That's a free one for you, Lifetime.
What were you going to say, Sarah?
I was just going to ask what Brandon thought of Lifetime's pivoting somewhat to extremely fast turnaround true crime docudrama, because I feel like I, you know, with a true crime newsletter, consume a lot of that material. And I feel like it's not that much different from the more fictionalized stuff that we are watching today, which, I don't know, if you're a certain age, you definitely got a bad Ronald vibe out of this one. I won't say anymore. But Brandon, I don't know if you have a sort of take on the expansion of their true crime franchising.
Well, I mean, I think the idea makes sense to their target audience, right? Which, you know, what better way to amp up the fear than, you know, true crimes? Like, hey, before these were dramatizations or like a story that you might have heard or just like just pure fiction. But if you can draw in an element of like inspired by true events, that makes it realer. Of course, you're talking about just a broader trajectory in media as a whole, though, too, right? So a lot of more things are being inspired. Well, it feels kind of quaint now that we're in 2020, but Lifetime movies can be a behind the curve in a surprising number of ways. But so, you know, it's not too hard to, you know, imagine that this is their first foray into the true crime inspired by real events wave that started maybe 5 years ago. Of course, there have always been Lifetime movies that were inspired by true events, right? You know, The Pregnancy Pact was inspired by true events. Cyber Seduction was theoretically inspired by true events. Girl Positive, a lot of things were inspired by true events. But I think that was more the typical marketing strategy to make the housewives and feel a little bit more, you know, oh, this could happen to my little Billy. So I will say, though, the true crime stuff to me is worse. Right. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, reality can't match up to fiction when it comes to, you know, crafting something to scare people that is like uniquely targeted at their lives. So like, okay, so like the true crime ones, the ones that are even the ones that are based on true events, as loosely as that might be, they tend to be a little bit tamer, have less violence or just a gratuitous sexuality in them than ones that they just come up whole cloth. So I think it's a balancing act in some senses.
Nowhere in reality are you going to have a killer or a star stalker come into your house and gift you with a pregnancy test mounted on a Bath and Beyond frame.
Box. Yeah.
Okay. That was wild. That was a great moment.
Yeah. So let's tie it back to Ruthless Realtor in particular. So Brandon, you let me know before the taping, it was particularly exciting in that it has some tendencies that you said are just emerging in Lifetime movies. What tendencies are those?
I want to say laziness, but in a very positive way. And by that, I mean, like, everything feels like, maybe this is just me spending too much time online, but movies nowadays just feel like a lot of them have become, I mean, maybe reality too feels this way. A lot of the, you know, more crucial elements of plot or backstory or like character motivation have just been sort of like, you know, sidelined so we can get to the better part, get to the better parts, right? We can get to like the bits that everyone actually wants to see, because like those parts, the lead up, the background, the plot, like the things that make the sort of like the world coherent or the people in the world relatable, you know, they don't, you know, like they don't matter anymore. So in reality, I feel as though, now that I'm saying it out loud, Lifetime movies, at least the ones made in the last, I want to say 2020, 2019, the latter half of 2019, they've kind of become more even horror movie-esque in their willingness to abandon even trying to explain the motivations of the characters as anything other than just like completely stupid or like, why would you even allow this? Like, and I said to this, like, you know, you keep mentioning the pregnancy test in the movie that the realtor, the ruthless realtor, eponymously named in the movie, ruthless realtor, obviously, that's what eponymous means. she gifts the couple that moves into the house that she's selling a pregnancy test that she found in their bathroom that she stole after accidentally revealing to the husband, who did not know the wife was pregnant, that she was pregnant after she had snuck into the house, or rather invited herself into the house that night to make brisket with the husband. Yeah, it's a whole thing. And so generally, this was like 10 minutes into the movie. Right. So this was like they had just met this woman 3 or 4 days before to get a house showing, signed some contracts after she showed up at their job. And so like they did not know her from, you know, Eve. Right. But like they just allow her to just hang around and intrude and be intrusive in their life to an extent that, you know, you would not normally allow a stranger to be. And that is kind of like newer in Lifetime movies. And it's not something that only exists in this one. It's just one that, you know, normally they have a little bit more like, oh, this person, like they're dating or they're renting this apartment from somebody. Yeah. Or like there's a reason why they would actually be allowed to exist in their life, even as flimsy as it might be, to, you know, to like to be able to like, you know, win their trust and gain this level of like of access to them, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, I hired a babysitter because I'm overworked and I need someone to watch my kid. And then like 6 months later, she turns out to be crazy, right? Or I met this guy online and, you know, he seemed cool. But, you know, 6 months later, you know, 3 months later or a few weeks into our date, he turns out to be a human trafficker. Like that's something like that. They met this realtor one day after driving past a home that was just for sale that you wouldn't assume they could afford, but who cares? Who knows what job they do? Everything in Lifetime, everyone in Lifetime movies has fake jobs. That's what I will say that too. So, and within 2 weeks, she's, you know, making brisket and like hanging their pregnancy test on, you know, in a frame for them. And like as the viewer, I'm like, why would you even allow her to do this? But as, you know, the viewer, I'm like, yes, let's keep escalating this. So I say, you know, that because it's like, that is relatively new. I don't know if you guys noticed that and thought it was just like, oh, Lifetime movies, they don't even bother. But like, no, that's actually a newer trend where you can just like start the movie and they have a home nurse working for their child who has muscular dystrophy. And they're like, oh, how'd you meet this nurse? And they just go, she just showed up one day and she was nursing my kid.
I just chalked it up to unwillingness to confront people and being too polite in the wrong situation,
yes.
Because that is something that I often happens to me. I'm like, I'll like engage into like a 15-minute conversation that I don't want to have with somebody I don't know. And I'm like, I could have just said no at the beginning if I had a little more balls, but I don't. So here I am watching this person making brisket. But can I just say on the topic of the brisket, what a great choice that was. Because doesn't brisket take like 12 hours to make? Like, don't you have to like slow roast it forever?
So.
And then she must have been there
for a while,
like at least almost half a day if she started the brisket from scratch there, right?
I love brisket. I would have let her in. So maybe it's just that's me. That's me just being too judgmental. Because I love brisket. I would have had to really consider it.
Well, I would have been like, you can leave the brisket, but you've got to go. I mean, this is definitely something that Roger Ebert called an idiot plot, which is that if anybody in the, you know, plot has a 5-minute conversation with each other about anything or behaves like an actual person and not like a character for 5 minutes, then the plot ends. So I can forgive that because it's, you know, TV and catalyzing events, whatever. But It just kept sort of repeating itself to the point where I would almost compare it to the plot, giant air quotes, in like porn.
Yeah.
But it's like, did someone order a pizza? Bonking ensues. Like, okay, fine. But I think that's what Lifetime is going for. And that's what Brandon was saying, that it's like they just strip away everything. Like literally the only reason she's even pregnant is so that they can do this completely outre thing where she mounts it on it's not even a picture frame because there's no glass over it. And it's like horrifying. You can almost smell the pee and it's like, oh, honey, no.
That's a great scene. And I'll say, you know, you can say it like it's bad, but you'll be thinking about it for a very long time.
It's true.
Oh, yeah.
But you won't forget that scene.
I was not bored.
No.
Like, the acting is okay. And then I'm married to a realtor and this was just hilariously, like, there's absolutely no way in, you know, like, this is California. Like, there are laws. You can't just fix it with the bank. I sort of admired the fact that everything in the movie existed to drive towards this like big reveal, and like that it made no sense and bore no relationship to the reality that we viewers all share.
It was the Lifetime movie equivalent of playing with your Star Wars action figures in the sandbox when you were a kid, where you weren't really concerned about why you got to the fight, but you got to the fight.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's all fireworks factory.
Yeah.
Fucking A. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt the same about this one that I did about the holiday movie that we watched, which is it felt like a Hallmark movie in the sense of like in quality, in tone, in acting effort,
including the husband doing faces at the wife behind.
Oh my god,
like, that was his character.
More than one take ever. Maybe?
Yeah, exactly. The non hilarity of the attempted comedy beats and like how few takes that they seemed to get, but. You know, but it's a Hallmark movie that is made for people who, you know, can handle the idea that things like sex and murder exist. But yeah, I definitely also, you know, appreciated the efficiency of the storytelling in terms of like As soon as we see Annie, it's established she's a lawyer. She's ignoring her husband. This is going to be a problem. Like, got it in like a second. Like, thank you. Like, I don't need to, as Brandon said, I don't need to know their whole backstory. Who fucking cares? Like, yeah. there's not one wasted character in this story. Like, we don't meet Annie's, you know, assistant at her office.
It's like five people, right?
Yeah. She doesn't have a sister. Like, they don't have parents.
So you've got her,
yeah.
The lead. She's sort of like, if this was a real movie, she'd be like Rosamund Pike. Is that her name?
Sure. Yes.
We've got Sutton Foster as the crazy, ruthless real character. Yeah. The guy could be anybody.
Yeah.
Craig Burko, Cooper. Whatever, sure. You know, sure.
And is anybody, I'm pretty sure.
We got the guy we've been calling Fawn Runches as the cop.
Yes. He's got like Ron Funches.
He's got a lot of Ron Funch energy. And
the pharmacist.
I will say, though, there are actually a bunch of famous people in Lifetime movies generally. Oh. They get a lot of sort of like ABC Family, Boy Meets World, Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Okay. A lot of like those types of actors end up in a lot of, you know, you see a lot of Ryder Strongs. What's Corey Matthews' brother's name? Oh my gosh, the actor.
Oh, Ben Savage?
Not Ben Savage, but his brother.
That is Ryder Strong, isn't it?
No, Ben Savage's actual actor brother is in some of them, but I mean, irrelevant to the point. But yeah, you get a lot of the same kind of stable, and a lot of the actors who are in one Lifetime movie are in a bunch of other ones. Uh-huh. So you get this sort of like canon of like actors who you see across movies who sometimes play different roles, sometimes always play the same roles. I will say, you know, to your point about the twist in this movie not making sense, all of these movies kind of have the exact same plot and the exact same structure. And, you know, I say it's evolved and it's become a lot less interest in the background and, you know, actual establishing of the legitimacy of like these relationships prior to like the movie. Because usually they, you know, they would spend the first like half hour of these movies doing that. And then everything you saw in Ruthless Realtor would happen. Then she would start like being weird and crazy. But they've kind of just started condensing that to the first 10 minutes. And I'm fine with that.
Good.
The issue is, though, I think in this situation, these movies, whether or not they have a more condensed lead up or not, kind of live and die by their twist. And they always have twists.
Yeah.
They always have twists. Sometimes they have double twists. Sometimes they have like a false twist. But like they are M. Night Shyamalan-esque in the fact that they just there will always be a twist. And, you know, more or less, the movie is defined by how good that twist is.
Right.
And, you know, some of the more gregarious elements leading up to it. Like, the, you know, the, because they are not afraid. And I guess this is the sort of other thing that I wonder about. Because, you know, the couple in this household, I have a hard time believing, like, the target demographic that I've constructed in my head for Lifetime movies would want to see themselves, like, ask that couple. And so like there must be some level of like voyeurism in it too, because the couple is too stupid to be like, you know, I guess empathetic with in some elements of it. And so like I feel like Lifetime movies more than other types of movies really kind of, I think, straddle that edge between like a level of like exhibitionist and voyeurism and empathy that you don't really see people towards. Like, the, because, you know, like, yeah, like this movie is kind of graphic.
Yeah.
Not as graphic as some of the other ones, but there's a lot of violence in Lifetime thrillers that you would think would be off-putting if you're just like, oh, I'm a housewife staying at home. But like, I guess, you know, it's not, right? That's just my bias.
Yeah, and Lifetime signal it by the, as Tara said, the titles of all these ones are so direct and to the point now. Like Ruthless Realtor, and like what was the bad
Deranged Granny is coming up next month,
and the, what was the pool boy one?
Psycho Pool Boy.
Psycho
or
Pool Boy.
Like,
like if it was real, it'd be like Bad News Dick Chopper, like, or like if they are, or like Hungry Man Dinners for Jeffrey Dahmer. Like they're
that's
so
too clever.
Yeah,
guy eats guy from freezer. The movie. Yeah. It's just so direct and to the point, and like it's so what's on the tin.
Exactly.
And I actually really do appreciate the acceleration to where you want to be. It's sort of like, you know, when you watch a movie that you're interested in, but you've seen the trailer and you get that sense that your first 20 minutes are wasted because you know, like, the guy's wife's going to die and then he'll be set up for vengeance. You know that from the trailer, but
right.
The movie's taking 25 minutes to get there.
Yep.
You're like looking at your watch like, I know what's going to happen. Yep. Can we please just accelerate? This does that,
yeah,
right?
Like Sarah said, it's all fireworks.
It's all fireworks. It's all star wipes.
Yep. Brandon, in your expertise, please tell our listeners, what are your top five Lifetime movies they should watch next after watching Ruthless Realtor?
Well, I have just an endless list of things I would love to recommend. But I like to give a spattering because there are just different types of movies, right? You know, for different types of people. For, you know, no matter what kind of troubled housewife you find yourself, you know, worried about STDs, worried about, you know, worried about your kid being human trafficked. I got you covered, okay. In fact. So at the top of the list, you know, speaking of twists in good movies, I have to put A Lover Betrayed. That's my current favorite right now because, like I said, these movies live and die by how good they do their twist. And I think this one has one of the better twists in the more absurd situations involved. A little dark, but depend. You know, I would say perfect to have a few drinks and the friends around.
Okay.
Coming at number two. This is one of my personal favorites. It has people mixed. I've received mixed reviews from people I've told to watch it. So it's up to you. Viewer beware. You know, you're in for a scare. The Choking Game. I think The Choking Game is one of the best examples of like, yeah, these movies all like play on the general idea of the anxiety of the suburban like lifestyle, the people sort of drawn to that lifestyle. But very few movies like, you know, mentioned before, like are so targeted to like one moral panic, one very specific moral panic that only existed for like a few months that no one ever talks about anymore, such like The Choking Game. Mm-hmm. And the movie is what it's, you know, what it says. No, it's about a bunch of kids who start playing the choking game and it just escalates out of control to a point of absurdity where it's like an app that monitors who's been choking themselves. It's a little silly, but I like it. And the ending is dark, so darkly funny that I always see it and break out laughing. So, you know, don't think I'm a weirdo if you see it and you're like, this is terrifying, but leave that there. Next up, I would say a classic one, although it's a little, the ones from the 90s tend to be a little in your face about some of the more gratuitous elements. And part of that has to do because, like, they actually have teenagers play teenagers. So, like, Degrassi kids or whatever, as opposed to, like, 19 and 20-year-olds playing high school kids, like, in the CW era that we are in now. So, like, it can be a little bit more, like, ugh. But classic one, She's Too Young, about the sort of the moral panic surrounding like the teen gonorrhea outbreak that happened in I want to say the 90s. Mm-hmm. And it's again kind of gross, kind of dark, but there's one element of it where anytime the kids do bad, anything bad or like dangerous or devious, they play fake rap music in the background.
Oh.
And it's just like, it's not like fake rap music in the sense like it's a fake real rap song. It's a fake rap song that is just like someone who sounds black saying things that upset suburban moms over a beat. And it's just like, don't do your homework, take off all your clothes, like dance around. It's like, it's hilarious.
Can we just hit pause so I could go watch this immediately? Because holy shit.
And yeah, and I think it has some of the characters from Degrassi in it. I think it's the one who plays the girl Spencer likes in the series with Drake. Irrelevant.
Okay. Yeah. Sure.
Another old one, I would say, Cyber Seduction. I want to say that the subtitle is his erotic life, but that might be wrong. So don't quote me on that. Okay. It's about another one that's from the turn of the century when like parents were really worried about their kids getting addicted to, I guess, online pornography.
Oh my God.
About this kid who's a swimmer, sees one titty online and it destroys his whole life. It just literally destroys his entire life. And it's a little hard to follow because like it's kind of like Lynchian and it's like sort of like a dream too, so you don't know is and is not real. Have you seen Vanilla Sky? It's a little bit like shame with Michael Fassbender and Vanilla Sky or like Existence into one movie.
Okay, place your bets. Has the human race ever combined Lifetime movie and Lynchian in the same paragraph before, do you think?
Oh my God. We did it.
Yes, and it's all like, so yeah, it's this whole thing about like, so it's kind of like a mix of like those movies, and part of it's because it's also told like a blue filter over the whole thing, like Donnie Darko. Uh-huh. And so like, it's very hard to tell what is and is not real. And so like, there's some point where like, there's a girl in his class who he thinks, who may or may not actually be a cam model, but it's just watch the movie. It's hard to, it's a lot more straightforward than I'm making it seem.
Okay.
And so I, you know, to round off the list, I would say, you know, I'm kind of torn on the inclusion of this one because it's not technically a Lifetime movie, but it's one that, you know, everyone talks about within the general, like, expanded Lifetime movie universe.
Sure.
It's Cyberbully.
Oh, I've seen that.
Oh, me too.
It's the one everyone has seen, and it's not good like a Lifetime movie is good, but it does hit on some of the same kind of plot points, but it has sort of a budget.
Yep.
And like sort of actors you can recognize. But like, I think it's great to see what we've become as a society has been predicted by Emily Osment.
Yep.
Emily Osment, the sister of the person who plays the kid who can see dead people in Sixth Sense. You know, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah, yeah. You know, that's, like, it teaches us how we should behave. The dangers of not behaving positively online in online spaces is that you might, I guess, kill yourself with Tylenol PM or something.
I don't even think it's that. I think it's Advil.
Oh, I don't think
you can't kill yourself with acetaminophen.
No.
It just gives you really bad, diarrhea.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't, you know, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter so much, but, like, it's a great movie, and one of my favorite parts about Cyberbully is that the kids take the bullying very seriously, and since that, they make it, like, a part-time job, when most cyberbullying is just like, oh, I hate this B word. Like, yeah, she dresses, yeah, she looks fat, and then you just, like, easily live with that. They were, like, doing whole skits, and I was like, no teenager has this much, like, all you do is play Fortnite now. No one is doing this.
Oh my God, thank you so much.
I'm just imagining the priceless end of that movie being, Mom, I got real bad diarrhea, and then the credits roll.
You would just get super bad cramps. Like, that's what happens when you take a bunch of acetaminophen, and it was like, and it's like 12-hour release acetaminophen. That is one of the best. Like, that scene is the only reason to watch that whole movie, but it's such a powerful, powerful scene.
Oh my God. Fantastic. God. All right, so Ruthless Realtor, seek that out. It's dumb. Man, we got to dip into some of those recommendations. Yeah, that's an amazing list.
Oh my God, we really do.
Bless you.
It's time for Around the Dial. First up, Tara.
Well, speaking of ABC Family RIP, I dipped into an offering this weekend from the channel that has taken its place, Freeform. Love in the Time of Corona. This is the mini-series featuring real families. I guess that's how they got around real families of actors shooting in, I guess, their own homes. Don't know. Doesn't matter. Starts a few weeks into quarantine, as we're told, ellipsis. And it's set in four households in L.A. We have James and Sade, played by Leslie Odom Jr. and his real wife, Nicolette Robinson, who is also an actor mostly on Broadway. He's a producer. She's been taking care of their baby at home mostly because he's away a lot. James's mother, Nanda, played by L. Scott Caldwell, who recently came up on Melrose Place. She's the character actor, Rose from Lost. She is later joined at her house by her other son, Diedrich, played by Katero Colbert. And her husband, Charles, who's played by Charles Robinson, Mac from Night Court, he has pneumonia.
That's right. Okay.
He's, oh yeah, Dave watched a little bit of this passively. He has pneumonia and he's recovering in like a short-term old seniors sort of nursing facility of some kind. Then we have Paul Gilbellos from Ally McBeal, his real wife, Sarah, Rhea Kilstead, and their real daughter, Sophie, played by Ava Bellows. And their relationship to the other two families is that Nanda was Sophie's teacher. And then we have Elle, played by Rainey Qualley, Andy McDowell's other daughter, not Margaret Qualley. Apparently there's another one. And Oscar, played by Tommy Dorfman. We don't find out their relationship to the other three households until the very end of the last episode, which I will get to. So if you don't want to be spoiled, stop listening, but also don't watch the show. I'm about to tell you why. I thought this was going to be an anthology show. I mean, there are four households and four episodes, so if they had each been siloed in their own episodes, that also would have been annoying. Instead, it's Love Actually in lockdown, which is, guess what? Annoying also. The Paul and Sarah plot is they were separated, but then their daughter came back from college to quarantine with them, so they were, like, faking it because they don't know how to tell her, even though she's 19. Sarah has just been commissioned to write a travel story and was supposed to go to Venice to write it for Condé Nast Traveler, and then, of course, that gets canceled because of quarantine, and I was more upset about that than about their marriage because I have also had work canceled by Condé Nast because of quarantine. Thanks a lot.
Oh, we all have.
Pandemic.
It's a universal story.
Yes. Nanda spends the whole time planning her 50th anniversary party and is in total denial both about her husband's cognitive decline and also the fact that this party is definitely not going to happen as planned on May 10th, which is confirmed in the last episode with footage of Eric Garcetti extending the stay-at-home order until May 15th. LOL. Remember when it stopped? I mean, I guess it did. And then they were like, oh, just kidding, and put it back on. Anyway, James and Sade, as I said, have a three-year-old that she's mostly been raising alone because of his career, and he thinks they should have another baby now because he's going to be at home for the foreseeable future. But then the Ahmaud Arbery shooting happens, and he changes his mind about having another kid. And his emotional crisis about the burden of raising a Black child in America is definitely the most considered topic that this show gets into, and I think is supposed to gesture toward the protests that start happening later in quarantine because the show ends before George Floyd's murder, and leaving it with James still not ready to try for another baby, I think, is the best choice the show makes rather than tie everything all up. But then we have Elle and Oscar. So they've been roommates for a long time. He's queer, and then he says he's been, like, maybe thinking he might want to sleep with women, and then all of a sudden she's like, I've been in love with him forever, even though she's thought he was gay this whole time. And then they go through this whole thing where they, like, swipe for each other, and he picks a guy for her that sucks, and she picks a guy for him that he really likes. And then they both get spooked, and they end up sleeping with each other, and it's horrible. And then she has this, like, flirty relationship with their neighbor downstairs who's, like, flipping the house. That's so stupid. And whatever. Sean and Oscar, the guy that she picks for him, end up getting together back together over Zoom. And then Sean makes this huge gesture of hiring a plane to fly over Oscar's house, flying a banner behind it that reads, "You can't quarantine love." And then Nanda is at this nursing facility, like, saying hello to the husband through the window because he's, you know, still in there. And then that's what ties them together with the anniversary car parade that's happening behind them. So here's what's not portrayed in this mini series about the COVID pandemic: anyone having a financial crisis other than kind of Dietrich, because we find out he gets laid off from his job, and then he just moves into his mother's guest house rent free, and that's it. Anyone dying of COVID does not happen. No one even makes reference to anyone they know dying of COVID, or, like, hearing about anyone knows dying of it. One person gets infected in the last episode. Like, maybe she dies in May or later. We don't find out. And, you know, I'm a big proponent of positive propaganda. I don't think Freeform was up to the task in this case, which they proved by sidestepping, like, all of the actual issues that people are facing in quarantine. And like I said, it ends sometime before May 10th, and the script has a big written in May in a hurry energy, which, like, maybe if there are aspects you're avoiding because you feel like you can't dramatize them because they're still in progress, that should tell you don't do this. So they should not have done this, and I watched this to confirm that for you. So it's all on Hulu if you want to watch it, but don't. It's not good. For my plug, I also watched Singletown. Speaking of things you shouldn't watch, this is a reality show on HBO Max that they have imported from Britain. It's really weird in ways that I won't get into because this is just a plug, but there's 15 episodes that all dropped at once, and I watched 10 to confirm certain things about it. So, British dating shows are super strange. Basically, the premise of this is, like, couples break up and then sort of date around with, like, people that the show picks for them. And then it's like, should we get back together? Maybe will this save our, you know, stale relationship? But then one of the people in it is 18, and we find out she's been dating her boyfriend for 3 years, which is like, ooh, that's creepy. You should not be on a reality dating show. Anyway, so we'll link to that in the show notes. That is on Primetimer.
All right, Brandon, what have you been watching lately?
If you couldn't guess from my love of Lifetime movies, I prefer to watch garbage. that's my preferred type of media when I'm sort of trying to enjoy and relax. And, you know, I make no bones about that. So I've been watching reality TV. I'm a big House Hunter International guy, but I've kind of exhausted that. And so I've gotten onto something new, you know, nothing, not new in the sense that it just came out, but new in the sense this is my first time watching it. I've gotten into The Amazing Race. I don't know if you've ever seen The Amazing Race. I remember hearing about The Amazing Race, I mean, essentially throughout my life when, you know, having TV, it was a big thing. Never really gave it any mind because I wasn't a big kind of survivor guy. Boy, was I wrong. The Amazing Race, I'm on season 5 now. I've blown through 5 seasons in maybe a week, and a half max.
Wow.
I mean, it is one of the most compelling character studies you will ever see. Just people who have no business being in any kind of relationship with one another, deciding to test the strength of that relationship in a series of physical and emotional challenges, all while revealing the worst of themselves and sometimes the best, but actually only the worst.
Yeah.
And the show is just, I know the word toxic gets overused online a lot in reference to relationships, but this is where it actually applies. The show is so full of toxic relationships, and it's also just generally edited so weirdly that it actually causes, at least, it causes the people who watch it to fight too, because it's just trying to figure out what's happening and what's going on and what the rules are to this race, because they're told in very extreme, very quick, like little bursts, and like, so sometimes it's just very easy to miss it. And then it's an amazing show. So I am on season 5. Obviously you have to watch season 1, but I would heavily suggest season 2, is magnificent. Because it's the first season where they decide to have one of the couples who, this is a trend on every season I've seen so far, at least 4 out of 5 ones, so most of them, where there is a team comprised of like a divorced couple who are using this race to get back together, or to decide whether they should get back together, as opposed to therapy, I guess, because that's simply not extreme enough. And it always goes the way you would imagine, of course. There's a reason they broke up, and there's a reason why they're doing this instead of therapy. And but this was the first season where there was an intergroup, inter-team relationship, and it just becomes like the overwhelming drama of the entire season. Like, and who wins is just a backdrop for like the continued toxic drama. I cannot recommend The Amazing Race enough. It might be the best reality show, at least, you know, at least up to what I've seen, ever. Best reality competition show that's not like a baking or a skill-based one,
yeah.
You know, to ever come out. And I'm going to really be sad when we get to the era of, you know, television where they got anywhere. You're just no longer allowed to be as toxic on television. You know, thanks Obama, where they're not going to let people just like go around the world and yell like racist things to people, or like abuse their spec. They do,
yeah,
but like,
they do.
You know.
Great news.
The early 2000s was a different time. And this show premiered in 2000. Like, what you could put on television in 2000 and what you can put on television nowadays seems like night and day when you think back to like Joanna Man being a movie back then. And how many movies Rob Schneider was in where he played some version of like an animal or a woman. Like, so really it's, you know, we've come not very far, but we drew the line at some point. It might have been at Rob Schneider, but I know he has a comedy special actually now that I'm probably going to watch. So maybe we didn't.
Yeah, those early seasons of The Amazing Race really are. It's so true. They're untouchable. Like, we fell off at a certain point, but you definitely have
pinpoint the exact point that I fell off. But I don't want to spoil anything for Brandon.
Okay. Yeah, but you have like dozens of seasons to go. Like, they're really it's a rich oeuvre.
What is the first season where Mike White pops up? Because that was
that's in like the teens. I think.
Is it? Yeah. Because
yeah.
I know they returned
twice. Yeah.
But that him and his dad are delightful.
They are great.
I know you're saying like so many of the pairings are toxic and don't work, but that's like one of the exceptions that they're like super charming, mm-hmm. and everything about them is delightful. So you have that to look forward to.
Yeah. I like the super charming team. Some teams are like super charming and they're just like really good friends. I don't want to spoil anything for anybody, but the, you know, some standouts so far were like the clowns in mm-hmm. season four. It's yeah. like, oh, like these two people are just like really good friends. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, you can kind of tell that they're just like brothers or like have a very positive relationship. They don't tend to win. you know, I mean, rather those teams that are super positive, but don't have like the athleticism of like other teams tend to go out, where like toxic teams, no matter what their athletic capabilities are, just can just drag on for forever.
Yeah. Fueled by bile, totally.
Fueled
yeah,
by
I think
evil.
It was
yeah,
the family edition where I was like, I don't think I can do this anymore.
Yeah.
Television Pity was very, very big on Amazing Race, so we are very connected to it. We used to go to the Tarcons and yeah. all that kind of stuff. Met Phil, and Phil is a delight. He is yes, just true. As charming as you hope he would be in real life. He seems like a really nice guy. So
yeah.
that part was nice to find out that it wasn't just
he has
on
great
camera.
Outfits. So,
yeah.
Great
yeah,
outfits true. In the earlier those earlier seasons have some looks in them. Oh my gosh. It's like being in a it's like being in a time machine seeing what people dressed like in 2000.
This is how we lived. Brutal.
And what do you want to plug? I believe you also are a podcaster.
Oh, I thought we were going to plug other shows. I was like, we should all watch Cobra Kai, too.
Oh. But
I've heard
oh,
that.
Yes. But yes, I am a podcaster. I do have a podcast, as one who is a podcaster tends to. my podcast is called The Discourse Podcast. And I host it with my friends, Richard, Adair, and John. And we generally have a lightish, you know, more collegiate, or sorry, what collegiate, no, maybe collegiate, depends on your perspective, I suppose, but more informal tone to, you know, discuss the politics, culture of the day. I've been trying to get them to do more pop culture stuff with me to lighten the mood, just picking random movies to watch. I've been trying to sort of like soft sell it to them, but they don't have my same tastes.
Good luck continuing to push your trash agenda. We support you.
And we'll link that in the show notes so everybody can find
absolutely, yes.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Well, this will raise the discourse. Just kidding. It will not. I am here to talk about Below Deck Med this season, which I am finally catching up on. This, I think, has got to be the most firings in a single season of anything. Like, including The Fucking Apprentice. Like, and it's not even over. Who knows? Like, is the boat gonna get fired? Okay, the first one was a second stew who decided that taking orders was not for her because I guess in Italy, everyone's a little more snuggly about, I don't know, being a boss. The chef serves these revolting nachos that even I, whose fantasy football teams were always named institutional starch, who will seriously eat anything with melted cheese, no matter how vile looking it is. I was grossed out. He gets canned mid-charter and is replaced by the bosun's boyfriend. Cool, that's bound to work out. The lead deckhand gets demoted for being creepy with the second stew, and then during post-production gets fired completely from like the entire Bravoverse, and I think isn't even allowed to have a cable system that carries Bravo anymore because he made a racist Instagram post. And then they just functionally edit him out of the remainder of the season. Like, he was real annoying on top of being a monster. So I don't miss him, but that's weird. And then the chief stew got shit canned for bringing Valium on board and failing to register it with the captain, which apparently is a violation of maritime law. So
whoa.
I guess this is also educational, sort of. So yeah, the name of the boat is the Wellington, and more like the well Wellington. Am I right? I am right. Don't bother. there's also the usual assortment of guests who should maybe rethink the thongs, and hilariously dry captioning of drunk slurring. It's like, I don't know, if you don't usually watch it and you start watching it and you're like, I don't know if I like this crew, it's going to be completely different in two episodes. So get some Below Deck Med. It's on Bravo. And it's definitely on the app. In other news, Cheers rewatch is sort of staggering through season three, which seems like it's a lot more like hugging and feelings based and not super credible on that tip. The bits seem really much bigger and broader than they were in season one, which felt a lot more like tighter and more contained. We just saw the Nancy Marchand as Frasier's mom episode. She's amazing, but it wasn't like as well written as it should have been, I felt. And Nicholas Colasanto is steadily looking worse and worse for wear in every episode. So that's, we're bracing for that to happen. So that's how that's going. For my plug, I wrote about the NXIVM sex cult documentary, The Vow, on HBO. If you were like, oh my God, 9 episodes. Trust me, worth it. I wish it were even longer. It's very good. And I wrote it up for Prime Timer, and that will be in the show notes.
All right, right here on the next Extra, Extra Hot Great Friday, we have Lunch with the Bishop, in which Tara explains that she had a dream with this fully formed TV concept, including that title. And before she explains what her brain pitched to her, Sarah and I have to develop our own shows with that title. Mm-hmm. Here is a very, very small piece of mine. They believe will prove Jesus Christ was Scottish.
Okay.
What more is there to that? Tune in Friday to find out. That's available to all supporters at any level on our Patreon, patreon.com/extrahotgreat. And we are off next week for EHG Prime. But while we're away, we'll be packaging 3 Patreon episodes together that are all listener-suggested topics. So look forward to that next week. And then the week after that, we'll be back with our regular sort of episode. It's time for the Canon user submission this week from our old friend Doug. Take it away, Doug.
Hi, Extra Hot Great. With Are You the One already successfully entered into the canon, I'm back with a spiritual successor to a bunch of horny queer people in a beach house. Children's cartoon, Avatar the Last Airbender. Season 2, Episode 14, City of Walls and Secrets. Avatar the Last Airbender first premiered in February of 2005, when the latest wave of anime was crashing over the American landscape. Most series were cheap to dub, allowing networks to translate then hundreds of episodes cranked out and to silo them into specialty anime blocks like Toonami or WB Kids. Enter Avatar, an American series pulling in stylistic elements from anime, but nicktooning the shit out of it. Instead of 50-episode seasons and recycled frames and transformation sequences, Avatar got a juicy budget and generous schedules. Room was carved out for jokes, character diversity, and distinctly American story beats. What resulted was an anime-inspired cartoon that could be shuffled into the Nickelodeon lineup without feeling out of place. Although not quite as catchy as the Gilligan's Island theme, the show does a pretty solid job of catching you up.
Water. Earth, fire, air. Long ago, the 4 nations lived together in harmony. Then, everything changed when the Fire Nation attacked. Only the Avatar, master of all 4 elements, could stop them. But when the world needed him most, he vanished. 100 years passed, and my brother and I discovered the new Avatar, an airbender named Aang. And although his airbending skills are great, he has a lot to learn before he's ready to save anyone. But I believe Aang can save the world.
Basically, imagine Captain Planet, but Heart needs to learn everybody else's powers. Season 2, Episode 14 focuses on the group entering the city. Avatar Aang, Water Tribe siblings Katara and Sokka, and new addition Toph, a blind earthbender who essentially uses echolocation of the ground to see. Add recently exiled Prince Zuko and his uncle already in the lower tier of the city, and you've got yourselves a stew. Before we even start, let's take a moment to appreciate the absolute beauty stuffed into every inch of this show. The sets and backgrounds are mostly hand-drawn with exceptional detail. The visual design for each building, sculpture, costume, everything is distinctly thought out. The soundtrack is particularly noteworthy, using East Asian instruments to match the rest of the aesthetic. Even though you can't see the reveal over a podcast, just listen to the moment where we enter Ba Sing Se.
Don't worry, Aang. We'll find Appa.
It's such a big city.
He's a giant bison. Where could someone possibly hide him?
The gang arrives and is given a tour by their eerie guide, Judy, with a wide, vacant eyes and a smile plastered to her face the whole time. The city is laid out in tiers, keeping classes divided by literal walls. We get to tour different levels, the university, the palace, all conveying the fear the public has towards government officials. We also get to explore the day-to-day details of a sprawling metropolis in this Captain Planet universe. It's believable that this is the society that gets built in a world where water, rocks, fire, and whatnot are controlled. Need a transport system? Build stone train cars and propel them by hand. Police weapons? Mosaic gloves that can mold into handcuffs or projectiles. Half the episode is spent chasing down a firebender whose cover was blown by heating a cup of tea with his hands. In a world of action set pieces, the little process details matter too. We also get in some time for cute jokes and character works along the way. The world is glad to bask in its weirdness, joking about its world of hybrid animals, or giving a throwaway gag to a corncob-sucking weirdo on public transit. We get bright spots of the kids just being kids, playing dress-up, or Iroh's recurring love of tea in this delightful exchange.
Have some tea while you wait.
This tea is nothing more than hot leaf juice.
Uncle, that's what all tea is.
How could a member of my own family say something so horrible?
Levity aside, the episode ends with the gang learning the city is controlled by Advisor Long Fei and his police force. The Earth King and his subjects know nothing about the Hundred-Year War outside. Any residents with knowledge of the war are essentially brainwashed in a process inflicted on Jet, a recently captured rogue.
Our economy would be ruined. Our peaceful way of life, our traditions would disappear.
There's no war in Ba Sing Se.
What are you talking about? Where do you think all the refugees come from? You can't hide it.
In silencing talk of conflict, Ba Sing Se remains a peaceful, orderly utopia. The last one on Earth.
There is no war within the walls. Here we are safe. Here we are free.
Rather than a tidy wrap-up, the episode ends with the gang defeated, forced to remain in the city and stay quiet with their kidnapped pet-slash-transport Appa held hostage. They admit defeat and are shown out by Judy, a completely different woman from before, with the same eerie smiling face.
Now Judy will show you home.
Come with me, please.
What happened to Judy?
I'm Judy. I'll be your host as long as you're in our wonderful city.
And the magic of this episode? It ends unsolved. The show spent a season and a half like any other kids' show, hopping from place to place, episode by episode, with some overarching plot, but not much that will mess with syndication or reruns out of order. With Ba Sing Se, the plot can lay down roots for a 7-episode string of Orwellian propaganda, dummy governments, palace intrigue. Despite its Y7 rating, it trusts its young audience to keep up. Complex themes are made accessible without being oversimplified, and sets a pace that builds foundation for future shows like Gravity Falls, Adventure Time, Steven Universe, more. Every episode of Avatar is a delightfully airy, colorful, visual, satisfying feast. It was added to Netflix 2 months into the pandemic, right when we needed that balm. However, specifically the setting of Ba Sing Se is when Avatar shows how rich a mine it can build, and the city of walls and secrets lays out every inch, feeling more than just table setting. There is no war in Ba Sing Se, but is there Avatar in the extra hot great canon?
Thank you, Doug. Brandon, you chose this from our list of submissions. Why don't you respond first? What did you think of this submission?
Well, I mean, I think that the submitter, Doug, was it? I believe it was
Doug.
Another great show from Nickelodeon, Doug. picked a great one, and he laid out a very good summary about the episode and what makes the episode so important in terms of the, you know, the overarching structure of Avatar as a show, the season itself, and also just generally speaking, Avatar's place in sort of like the, I don't know, the transition of cartoons in some senses from just being, you know, this, or rather, Avatar as a bridge, ironically enough, between like the American cartoons that Nickelodeon is putting out in the more Japanese anime style cartoons that were dominating like Cartoon Network's Toonami block. I have seen Avatar many times, and I know exactly what episode this is, and it was why I picked it, because I agree. It is actually one of the more important episodes in Avatar because of the fact that, you know, up until this point, as mentioned in the submission, the show is, you know, it has its darker moments. It deals with death. It deals with sort of loss, specifically or most prominently in the end of the first season in, the death or reincarnation or like ascendance of the moon spirit, who was Sokka's girlfriend at the time, in order to defeat, or rather to save the world. But, you know, a large part of season two, the middle season of the three season Avatar, is spent looking for an earthbending master for Avatar, who turns out to be Toph. But also with the explicit goal of getting to Ba Sing Se, the capital city of the Earth Kingdom, in order to secure the support of the Earth King to basically turn the tide in the war against the Fire Nation, and also before the solar eclipse, right? Because one of the things that they are rushing to the Earth Kingdom to tell the Earth King is that Sozin Comet is going to be sort of the end game of the Fire Nation's plan to end the war/invasion and use that comet, which empowers Fire Nation firebenders, to like just carve a swath through the Earth Kingdom and take it over. And so like they're in a rush, they're in a hurry, they need to speak to the Earth King. This is like their last hope, Obi-Wan Kenobi, and they get to the city of walls and secrets of Ba Sing Se, this huge three-layered city, essentially akin to Attack on Titan, and the layers, just like Attack on Titan, are representative of the different castes or social classes that live in each layer, with the poorest being the outer, you know, at the further outer wall, and the inner circle being the aristocracy. When they get there, they realize that there is not only the stratification of classes, right? Well, some people starve, some people, you know, so this is like enough explicit class commentary there. But also they realize that the broader landscape of the world is being kept from the people. And that, you know, and then like, and that leads to, like I said, like he said, a 7-episode, you know, more or less, I guess, you know, mini series, but like mini arc that consists of intrigue and propaganda and kidnapping and hypnosis and like mind control and, you know, more death, you know, and eventually it becomes like the darkest moment up until that point of the Avatar chapter. At the end of the, it ushers in sort of like this change of tone and even change of status from the Avatar and the group of the Avatar gang as like this group of sort of happy-go-lucky, you know, rebellion, you know, trying to secure allies all over the Earth Kingdom, and, you know, as they travel, to more of a guerrilla fighting force in season three.
This is very helpful. This is, I mean, I, as I said in DM this morning, like, I'm so glad you picked this because we all had no context for this show. We'd never watched it before. So your expertise on this as well as on Lifetime movies is extremely welcome.
I knew it was a very well-regarded show for people of a certain age, right? I mean, mm-hmm. It's one of those informative shows if you're, I don't know, 30 now or something, I think.
Yeah.
Thereabouts, 20 to 30 maybe, mm-hmm. You know. I did watch the first couple episodes when I saw this submission first come in, because I was like, it was always in the back of my mind. It was like a well-regarded show. I know some of the, like, Dave Filoni, the guy that I have a love-hate Star Wars relationship with that I mention every time we talk about Mandalorian or something like that. He was involved with this show. Like, there's a pedigree here that I am familiar with. I hadn't watched the series through. And then we get to this, which is like smack dab in the middle of the run. I wouldn't say I was lost, but, you know, I lack some of the you know, the nuanced knowledge of this and that. I mean, it wasn't that hard to follow, but overarchingly, I would say I would love to have a show with this complexity and depth when I was 12, 13, kind of, you know, like growing out of the Star Wars action figures and the Sandlot plot devices, and then craving for something a little bit more and getting it while still getting your fix of
kicks and punches and fantastical devices and all that kind of stuff that as a kid you still hunger for. And it is interesting. I didn't know going into this, or I didn't really think about it, that this was an American production. It's strange though, because when you watch it, it still feels like it's dubbed because of the low fidelity of the animation, right? You know, because it's that style, it's that 70s, 80s animation style with all the three bean shapes of the mouth that entails. So I was like, I didn't, even watching the first episode, the pilot, I was like, oh, okay. Like that was a style choice, but I was just like, oh, this actually is an American show. I was kind of like just surprised by it as a first watcher. The first episode is actually kind of funny. Like there's a lot of humor in it that obviously they shed. Like this seems to be the series Empire Strikes Back moment. The heroes are at their nadir. People are trapped, are captured. They're, you know, between a rock and a hard place. And that darkness is something that you just didn't get when I was a kid. I mean, like once in a while you would get something, and actually it would be usually from Japan. Like the one dark cartoon that I remember watching as a kid was Star Blazers, where like people died once in a while, planets got blown up, the moon, which we all love, got split or blown up or something like that by the Comet Empire. Like these were the moments that for American audiences or North American audiences that are used to just a cartoon, a show that will reset itself after every episode so that they can show them out of order. It didn't really matter, right? There was no arcs involved for the most part. I would have gobbled it up. Super old me watching this, a little bit different. Like, okay, so we're dealing with an authoritarian analogy here. You know, they are in China, they are in North Korea, and it's not a complex device, but for kids, it's great. Like, it's nice to have them exposed to some of the shit that happens in foreign lands, question mark.
Yeah.
And while I do take some exceptions to some of the things he said, like, I don't think the depiction of this is a earth-bending nation so that it make all their earth-bending devices make sense. Like, the rock train makes no sense. Like, they have other stuff. It's not like they wear rocks and they don't know what cloth is and they don't know what a wheel is and all that sort of stuff. Like, this isn't bedrock. Like, it almost makes it like bedrock, right? It's like that kind of stuff.
Pokemon,
like,
it's Pokemon logic. Yeah, you know,
I understand what they're doing, right? You know, it's very George Lucasian monoculture approach to it. Like, this world is all forest. This world is all this. Like, this nation is just rocks and all their, you know, all their technology is based on rocks. But, you know, it doesn't really hold up to scrutiny, if you ask me. Also, some of the choices, like obviously, as Doug said, like the music is Eastern Asian tinged. The culture of the whole show is the same, or at least what we see in this episode. But then you got voices like Clancy Brown playing like the administrator and stuff. So it's like some of that, those choices are kind of weird to me. I really enjoyed as Uncle Iroh. He is. Did you recognize Uncle Iroh's voice, Sarah?
Yes, I did. Mako, who played Aku.
He played Aku, yeah. He's also the sorcerer from the Schwarzenegger Conan movies.
Oh, right.
I would have absolutely loved and gobbled this up when I was 30 years younger. Now I appreciate what a 30 years younger me would like about this show. Me, too late for me to be like rapturously in love with this, just because I am eating it as a old bag of bones, not as, you know, a teenager, which is like when I should have watched it, yeah. Ideally. Mm-hmm. But I appreciate what it's doing. I appreciate that it's bringing dark and heavy themes into it. I appreciate that the world is not reset all the time. And the production values are pretty good. Keep in mind, this is like before computer animation really took over a lot of the lifting that, you know, matte paintings and stuff like that than this show would do. So I do appreciate it. I do like that it's around. I'm arriving too late, but it won't stop me from voting in it.
Okay. Sarah.
You know, anything with the voice of Aku in it is going to is going to get me part of the way there. The problem is that I am also an old and I have no context for this, but one of my criteria when I'm being sort of dropped into a show that I don't really know is, would I keep going? And I would keep going with this. It had in look, and at least in this episode in tone, there was this Miyazaki, mm-hmm. Spirited Away, Studio Ghibli, feel to it that I liked, that, you know, even if I don't entirely understand what's happening, or it's like, oh, well, now we're in the soot sprite abode, and like, now we're, you know, we've lost like the main plot, but we're catching up with the soot sprites. Okay. Like, I don't know. There is a like trust with those movies that it's sort of like, well, this is going to be striking, at least, even if I'm not 100% sure that I know what's going on. This was enjoyable, but I'm not sure how I'm going to vote, because while I would keep going with it, and while I liked it and it reminded me of other things that I really like, I don't know if I know enough to vote for it. So that's where I'm at. We'll see what happens. But first, Tara.
Before Tara goes, I want to say one more thing, and one element that was missing from the other episodes that I watched that I wish was in this episode for the sake of just getting a more rounded, was the character that they're talking about, their ride, Appa.
Yeah.
Is sort of like this Falcor meets Chewbacca character that is very endearing. It's like one of the heart touchstones, you know, that yeah. you're missing.
Yeah. After I saw the bear, I was sad we didn't get to see the bison. Brandon, what were you going to say before I proceed?
Oh, yeah. No, I definitely agree with everything everyone has said. It's kind of a hard thing, especially this was aimed right at my generation. You know, I was that kid who rushed home after school to watch like Dragon Ball Z and Sailor Moon on Toonami. And the episodes were always out of order. And so who knew what anything or like being who knew right. what was happening or anything. And so like, it's kind of hard to think about watching Avatar for the first time as an adult without that context. But I think also, I mean, I can appreciate that, like you've all said, you know, certain things that I like now, like She-Ra, for example, the Netflix show, Princess of Power, I have to acknowledge, I think, following the genealogy very heavily of the Avatar, which, of course, you know, follows very heavily in other footsteps as well. So, you know, it's you know, it's kind of like the Seinfeld effect. Like, could you go back and watch Seinfeld after having seen the last 30 years of sitcoms and find it anything other than like weirdly like derivative in some sense? But please, yeah. sorry to interrupt.
I don't have a ton to add to what Sarah and Dave and of course Brandon, our expert, had to say. This certainly was beautiful, as Doug said. I agree with that. And I was interested in the world building. I mean, at the end of it, I sort of felt like, you know, as we've all said, I don't have any context for this, but I also was interested in going forward, especially once I read the description where it said the next episode was, you know, it sort of felt like, you know, 22 short films
yeah,
about bossing.
I saw that
was like,
too.
Oh,
yeah.
okay. I yeah. mean, I'd be interested to yeah. see like what this next episode is with these characters, like exploring this world or having sort of, you know, siloed adventures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
it was compelling to me. So yeah, I mean, I already
and said then that. The next episode after that is a flashback kind of thing, right?
Tales of Ba Sing Se is a very good episode. And I think that's where, you know, the choice kind of lets itself down, because this episode, as was mentioned in the submission, in the following, everything after this episode up until the end of the season, so I get about 7 episodes, it kind of is just like this one big event that you kind of have to like put into, I don't want to say like, I'm not making excuses for the episode, but like, taken together, it's more, I would say, than the sum of its wholes. What makes this episode so important, I would argue, is that it ushers in the following episodes that have a more, you know, long-lasting effect on the show itself, right?
Right.
I mean, in many ways, you can sort of separate the show Avatar into the things that happen before they enter Ba Sing Se and the things that happen after they end Ba Sing Se.
Right.
And, like, if you watch, you know, if you watch an episode from the first, you know, season and a half, you get not necessarily a different, well, there is a slightly different tone, but there's just a slightly different level of, I'm gonna put it this way, like, these are they're distinct, right? You would, like,
got
you know,
it.
Yeah.
In many ways, you can watch, like, you can tell that something must have happened in between these two, but without having that kind of context, you wouldn't know what it is. But I agree, it is very much the Empire Strikes Back moment of the
this
series.
This is all very Joseph mm-hmm. Campbell
yeah.
stuff. Like, but, they're not rewriting the playbook here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, that's what I meant insofar that I understand where they were in that story, in the yeah. hero's journey.
Yeah.
Like, this, yeah, this is that moment, mm-hmm. the midpoint where, you know, the tests of, you know, faith and everything start, right?
Yep,
but
definitely
speaking to Brandon's point, what I do appreciate about what I have seen about Avatar
in its place in just animation history is that, like, things are so much more sophisticated and considered now for with kids' entertainment than it ever was when I was growing up. Like, to have a continuing storyline, just that alone, is kind of, like, something you didn't really have before. Like, at the most, like, you would get a character that was introduced, and that would be a marker that this was, like, newer than season two or something like that, right? But you wouldn't get these stories that are connected and grow and characters that come in and out and all that kind of stuff. So, like, not that this started it, but I feel like, you know, this is, like, a major or at least a generational marker in that progress, and I appreciate that.
All right.
Okay, so let's put this to the official vote. Mm-hmm. Brandon, what say you? Canon worthy?
I would say definitely. You know, if you're a fan of the show Avatar, with that caveat, you know this episode, you know what's coming, and that excites you. You know, in many ways, if you're not, it kind of, it's kind of like turning on the last 25 minutes of Empire Strikes Back and be like, oh, what's happening?
Yeah, I'll co-sign that. I did enjoy it. I do wish I came into it. I wish I had, like, an extra, like, week so I could bone up a little bit more, but I can see what they're doing and I appreciate that. So I'm going to say yes too. Sarah D. Bunting, undecided up until this moment. Decision time?
I am, but it made me want to watch more and reminded me of things that I already watched that I loved. And I trust Brandon. Brandon, don't fuck it up. So I'm voting yes.
Yeah, I'm going with I was definitely waiting for the canon for what ended up being, I didn't know at the time, Doug's case, and for Brandon's guidance. And so based on both of those, I am also going to vote yes.
All right. So that means it's 4-4-4. Avatar, The Last Airbender, Season 2, Episode sometimes 13, sometimes 14, depending where you go, City of Walls and Secrets. You are hereby inducted into the extra on Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
No.
It is time for the winner and the loser of the week. Tara has the winner.
I'm interested to see if this is sort of heralding a new era of crime stories where no one really got hurt and they're just kind of fun. But literary scammer Dan Mallory, his movie, the film adaptation of his novel, The Woman in the Window, still TBD when it's coming out. Last I heard, maybe Netflix, since it was supposed to come out theatrically this year. Possibly that's probably not going to happen. But if you read the story about him in The New Yorker, you know all about his whole deal and how he is a literary scammer. If you didn't, you should check it out because it's really good. Anyway, why he is a winner is that he's going to be portrayed by Jake Gyllenhaal in a limited TV series from Jenixa Bravo, who is also the director of Zola, the forthcoming feature film, which I also am super excited about. Speaking of crime stories where no one got hurt. So, yeah, good news for him.
And loser of the week.
Drunk History, which is not proceeding with the seventh season. Comedy Central had already picked up. I think they had already shot like four of them.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think Derek Waters said something about it recently. Every time I see something about it on Twitter, I just get mad all over again. I think I have never laughed harder at a show consistently than I did at Drunk History. There's still a few sitting on my DVR and I'm going to treasure them. The network also reversed its renewal of Tosh.0. The other two in Southside are going to HBO Max. Like, it's sort of hard to figure out what Comedy Central's game is right now.
I feel like comedy channels every once in a while decide that they have to do a 180 to the other thing. Like, I feel like Comedy Central in years past have been like, we got to do a lot more stand-up, guys, because this is the comedy thing. And then, like, 2 years later, it's like, we got to get into scripted in a big way.
Yeah.
And then later, yeah, it's like, we got to do the animation stuff. Guys, let's go. And, like, just why not do them all?
Right.
They're all comedy, guys. You don't, you know.
Yes, yeah. But as I was saying to Sarah on Slack this morning, like, if that's the pivot Comedy Central is doing, like, where are you going to shoot your stand-up specials in New Zealand? Like, it's the fucking pandemic. Like, no one is going to clubs.
Hello. I know that there's a new guy there, and this is why they're all getting cut. But what is he saying that the new thing is?
No one knows.
No one knows. It's just not all this.
Well, and it could also be, like, Netflix also unrenewed The Society, and I am not okay with this. So maybe it's just one of those things where it's like, it's 2020, and we have to look like we have a plan, even if we don't.
I feel in my heart and my bones that Drunk History will get picked up somewhere else.
I mean, that feels like a show that should be on Netflix.
It does.
Like that's something where it's like if that dumped 15 episodes on a Friday, like you would eat those up over that.
And how much does that show cost? Like it's $3. It's not an expensive production.
Depends on what they're drinking, I guess.
Speaking of breaking out the
cheap.
expensive bubbly.
Speaking about other people coming in on your turf, do you know what time it is?
Sorry.
It's game time. All right, everybody, this is the fourth game time of the season. The score is all tied up, one apiece. Sarah won, Tara won, value guess one. Today we are playing changes. That's changes. Three ches, then one changes. From Corey A.H. Remember Corey?
Yes.
Hi, you've reached the Corey hotline. $4.95 a minute. Here are some words that rhyme with Corey. Glory. Story. allegory.
She earns
Montessori.
Oh, she wasn't done. She earns herself an extra credit topic. All right, so we're going to play two rounds today, but it is still a short game. In round one, I will give you the original name of a TV series as it was sold or filmed for the pilot episode. I'm going to also give you the year that show debuted and the network on which it debuted. You have to tell me the actual name of the show that we know it by. So shows that started off with different names, like how the Seinfeld Chronicles became Seinfeld, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Gotcha.
You will get 2 points for naming the eventual final name of the series as it aired. You can ask for a hint in which I will give you one of the main actors of the show, after which a correct answer is worth one point. Make sense?
Can you guess
wrong? I'll explain round two when we get to it.
Yes. Oh, do we get a free guess or guesses?
One guess.
Yes. Got it.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Let's throw it to Piggy. To see who's going first.
We will start with Sarah.
All right. So our order is going to be Sarah will go first, and then Brandon, then Tara. We've got 18 questions in round one, 9 questions in round two, 1 gross worth equalizer challenge zone, and a tiebreaker if we need it. Are we ready to play changes?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
All right. Here we go. Starting with Sarah D. Bunting. The original name of this show was 6 of 1. The show debuted in 1994 on NBC. What do we know that show as today?
Friends.
Is it Friends? It is, and that is 2 points. Brandon, here is your first clue. This show was originally known as 36, the number 36. It debuted in 2016 on NBC. So the pilot... Or the show was sold as the title 36. This show debuted 2016 on NBC. You can take a guess at the title or you can ask for a hint.
Is it This Is Us?
It is This Is Us, and that is 2 points.
Nice. Are you serious?
Yep. Well done. Why is it called 36?
Because in the premiere, they're all of the triplets. They're turning 36. It's their birthday.
Got it.
I have never seen that show, or that was the wildest
That's an
guess.
Incredible guess, Ben.
You know what that show on Lifetime would have been called? Killer Crockpot.
That's right.
Tara. Yes.
36 and Deadly. Yeah.
Chick and Dicks.
I just found this out in an article recently.
2011 Fox, it is.
It is New Girl.
2 points.
She is bad at naming shows, Liz Merriweather.
Back to Sarah D. Bunting. The show was originally called Surgeons. It debuted in 2005 on ABC.
Surgeons?
Correct.
I don't know why I keep getting Grey's Anatomy questions lately, but I'm pretty sure that's Grey's Anatomy.
Is it? It is. Well done. Everybody's getting those 2 pointers. Back to Brandon. This show was originally called Montauk. It debuted in 2016 on Netflix.
It's called Montauk?
It was originally going to be called Montauk.
Can you spell that for me, please?
Yeah, like
is it's
like
a U?
Like the town at the end of the line in New York. Montauk.
Is it Schitt's Creek?
It's not Schitt's Creek. This clue would have helped you. Finn Wolfhard.
Oh, I forgot. That's where it took.
Is it Stranger Things?
Stranger Things. I don't think they actually use Montauk, but it's something like that, isn't it?
Oh, I did actually know that one. That's funny. I actually heard that.
Back to Tara.
Yes, sir.
This show was originally sold or piloted as Lenny, Kenny, and Penny from 2007 on CBS.
The Big Bang Theory.
The Big Bang Theory is correct. Back to Sarah. This show, originally sold as Teenage Wasteland, 1998 on Fox.
On Fox.
Yes. Take a stab at that title, or you can ask for a clue, and I'll give you one of the leads.
I just wish it weren't on Fox.
I know.
Because then I would fucking know what it is. Can I have a hint, please?
Sure. We roll towards each other in our fancy cars. You roll down the window and you ask for any Laura Prepon.
Oh, that 70s show?
That is correct. Good for 1 point. 1 point.
Sure.
All right, Brandon. Your show, House of Sisters. House of Sisters. It debuted 1998 on the WB. House of Sisters, 98 on the WB.
Charmed?
2 points. Well done. Tara.
Yeah.
Good morning, Miss Bliss.
Saved by the Bell.
1989 NBC, Saved by the Bell. Back to Sarah. Your show is called Nowhere. It debuted 2004 on ABC.
Nowhere.
Where?
2004 ABC.
Correct.
Desperate Housewives?
Nope.
The other one.
You're going to really hit yourself when you find out it's Lost. Lost.
Oh, that motherfucker.
Back to Brandon. This show was originally going to be called House of Comics. It debuted 1987 on ABC.
House of Comics?
House of Comics, correct.
Like a stand-up comic.
I assume so, yeah, but it's spelled, yeah, spelled that way.
Okay, and you said 1987?
1987, ABC.
1987, House of Comics.
Yes.
Well, that's before I was born. Let's see.
Well, you can ask for a hint if you're not sure. I'll give you one of the leads. Or you can just take a stab at it.
I'll take the hint.
All right, your hint is Dave Coulier.
Oh, Full House?
Full House. Good for 1 point. Smart use of the hint. Mm-hmm. Tara, this will take us into our first score break.
Yes, sir.
For you,
okay.
The show is called Oil. 1978, CBS.
Dallas.
Dallas is correct for 2. All right. High scoring game, I think. Let's hear the scores.
It is. It's very close. I have 8 points. Sarah and Brandon are tied with 5 points each.
How exciting for all involved. Very exciting. Because you were tied for last place, you get work together collectively to try to answer 3 of the 6 questions on this newer set of TV questions I have.
Ooh.
Yep.
We spent some of our Patreon funds, put it back in R&D, and I bought the Trivial Pursuit Pop Culture 2 box. Now, it's not all about TV, but every card has a TV question.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to have to blow through 6 cards for every time.
Oh,
but
I see.
It's worth it because this is about 15 years older than the other one, maybe
newer.
20 years.
Newer.
I mean, newer? Yeah. Yes. From 2005, this was published.
All
so
right. Good luck, guys.
Got some good stuff here.
Okay, so how many points do they each get if they win?
2 points each.
2 points each. Okay, yes. Good luck, guys.
Okay.
And if we run the card, we get 4 points
That's
each,
That's correct.
Right?
If you run the card. Which maybe you will. I don't know. Like,
you
I
could.
Haven't really looked at these questions closely yet. But
okay.
let's see how we go.
This is very
so these are all just TV.
Yes.
There's no
okay.
individual
okay.
like comedy or anything like
okay.
that. Here we go. What government agency does John Cleese's character work for in Monty Python's classic Silly Walks sketch?
Oh, well, Monty Python, I think, is British. I'm not a big comedy person. I find laughing to be disconcerting. But, I would guess MI6 or MI5, but that assumes this is not some sort of American sketch. But so, I mean...
I think it's the Ministry of Silly Walks, but Like, I also think that they just told us the name of the sketch, so I'm not sure how to answer that.
The government agency that John Cleese works for in the Silly Walk sketch.
I don't know. I'm comfortable saying MI6.
Let's go with MI6.
And the answer is the Ministry of Silly Walks.
Fair.
Okay. That seemed too easy. Like, they told us Silly Walks. Why? Okay. Sorry.
No, that's my fault.
No, it's okay.
What nutty nickname does enforcer Peter Paul Galtieri answer to on The Sopranos?
Sarah, take it.
Paulie Walnuts.
Paulie Walnuts is good.
Yeah, you're on your way.
What Scandinavian nation spawned the survivor craze with a show called Expedition Robinson?
Ooh. Huh. What country was it?
Scandinavian. Which one?
Sweden? Would it be Sweden?
That sounds like a Swedish thing, so let's go for it.
Correct. Sweden indeed.
Just need to get one more right.
One more, and you both get two bonus points. What show passed? See, you know, it was published in 2005. Doesn't mean we're not going to have old shows, apparently. What show passed? The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet to become the longest-running comedy in TV history. And I guess it's kind of odd. What show finally beat Ozzie and Harriet as the longest-running comedy on TV?
At the time of this, they made this, or generally?
Yeah, mid-2000s.
Well, I mean, the only thing I could think of would be The Simpsons, but, like, that would be now, probably. But I can't think of any show that's been on longer than The Simpsons.
Ozzie and Harriet was on that long? And also, what might have passed in it? Like, could MASH qualify? Because that was on sooner and was on for a while.
I mean, all I know is that they usually refer to The Simpsons as, like, the record-breaking, like, Simpsons comedy show or something. But I don't know if we're talking about live-action shows or...
Yeah, I don't either.
Gonna need an answer.
I would say MASH, and I'll take the blame if I'm wrong.
Are we agreed on MASH?
We can agree on MASH.
That's Simpsons.
Oh, God.
All right, you got two more cards to get this.
Sarah's Costanzaing out today.
What event did Comedy Central air to mark the occasion of its 13th anniversary?
Oh, God. What happened? When was the 13th anniversary of
Personal event. Let me give you that personal event. So not an event in the world, but an event that we all experience. Well, people experience.
The only thing I can think of it would be someone's birth or like death, but I don't know who that would even be. So
yeah, I don't either.
It was
either.
2005, so I don't know who. I couldn't even guess who it would be in 2005. Did Tony Hawk die then? No, he's still alive. Tony Hawk is still alive.
Might as well be dead, I guess. I'm going to buzz you on that one. The answer is a bar mitzvah.
Oh, sure.
All right, so you need this. You got to get this, guys.
Guys, I believe in you.
Got to put on your TV thing.
I believe in you.
What?
You shouldn't.
MTV show's visit to Ozzy's pad provided the inspiration for the Osbournes.
You got this.
Cribs?
Cribs is correct. At the wire, you got your points.
Ding.
Well done. Whew, that was a roller coaster, guys.
It really
was. I'm kind of exhausted.
Yeah.
That was great.
So let's get the updated scores, please.
Okay, well, I still have 8 points now. Sarah and Brandon still tied, but now they're tied with 7 points each.
All right,
close
game.
The gap.
Let's get back to it. Back to Sarah D. Bunting. To remind you, this game is about shows that started with different names.
Yes.
Not the Cosby Show. Not the Cosby Show. 1987 on Fox.
The Cosby Show. Hint.
Katie Sagal.
Married with Children.
Are correct. To Brandon. Alexis, Texas. 2006, Disney.
Alexis, Texas, 2006, Disney. Hannah Montana.
Hannah Montana, correct. 2 points. Tara.
Yes.
2005, yep. FX, Jerks.
It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Correct. Everybody's last question in round one coming at you.
Okay.
Sarah D. Bunting. Life and Stuff. 1988, ABC.
Life and Stuff?
Yep.
Wow, that's a lazy title.
Yeah.
30-something.
Oh, that's such a good guess.
Anybody else? No.
No.
The one of the lead actors was Laurie Metcalf. That was Roseanne.
Oh, wow.
All right, to Brandon. Your show is called Leave the Bastard. Leave the Bastard. It debuted 2009 on CBS.
Leave the Bastard, 2009, CBS.
Correct.
Okay, 2009. Where was I in 2009?
Watching Avatar.
Yeah, clearly. No, I think that was like way earlier. I was like, that was 13. 2009. I think I know, but can I have the lead?
Sure. One of the leads is Archie Panjabi.
Archie Panjabi. So I did not know. I'm glad I asked for the clue.
What did you think it was?
I was thinking to go with King of Queens, but since that would not be the answer to that question, I would imagine 2009.
Yeah, 2009, CBS, Leave the Bastard, one of the credit actors, Archie Panjabi. Not the lead, though. Not the lead.
Archie Panjabi.
And if you don't know who that is, that's a lady.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know who that is. Yeah. Still, but I will say, I'll take a stab in the dark, CBS, and I got nothing, just blanked on it.
All right, anybody?
Sarah knows.
Yeah, Good Wife.
The Good Wife, yes, The Good Wife.
Oh.
All right, last question of round one.
Okay.
For Tara. Mm-hmm. The show is called Cool, 1974 ABC.
I'm going to need a hint, please.
Marion Ross.
Oh, Happy Days.
Happy Days and the Fonz and the Cool and all that stuff. All right, that is round one. Scores, please, Star.
Still a very close game. I have 11 points. Brandon has 9 points. Sarah has 8 points.
All right, everybody has 3 questions left, so 6 points in play for each of you.
Okay.
We'll get right back to it. Round two changes the formula a bit. This is how it's going to work. I am going to give you an actor who was replaced.
Oh,
at some point during the series. It might have been during the pilot. It might have been after airing.
Okay.
But this actor was replaced by somebody else. I will give you the actor. I will give you the show, year, and network like before.
Mm-hmm.
You have to name the actor that eventually replaced them.
Okay.
The hint is the show.
Okay.
Make sense?
Yep.
Sarah.
Yes.
Jennifer Ely. 2011. HBO. Jennifer Ely, 2011, HBO. She was replaced by somebody else. Who was that somebody else? If you need a hint, I will tell you the show we're talking about.
Somebody else. I don't think it would really help. So I'm guessing the actor who replaced Jennifer Ely.
That's correct.
Correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Emilia Clarke. Why not?
Emilia Clarke is very close, but incorrect. We were looking for Michelle Fairley, who played...
I knew it was her. I can remember her name.
Yeah, who played Catelyn Stark on Game of Thrones.
Right.
Brandon, your actor who was replaced is Rebecca Gayhart. 2002, Fox.
Ooh,
looking for the actress that replaced her. If you need a hint, I will tell you the show we're talking about.
Rebecca Gayhart, Fox. What was the year?
2002.
Ooh, and Fox, 2002. I need the name of the show.
The name is Firefly.
Oh, God, I hate it.
Brandon, when can you come back?
Yes, seriously. Where have you been all our lives?
We love Firefly.
You've caught me at a disadvantage here because I've only ever seen Buffy by Angel, obviously, by Joss Whedon, and I gave up on Firefly like 2 episodes in.
Sounds familiar. So I
have one and a half.
I have no idea. I've seen Serenity though. So surprising.
Yeah, me too.
Enough.
Yeah. Any guesses from the
Marina Becker?
It is. It is. Yes, indeed. All right, Tara. Here's your first one.
Okay.
Janet Huber, or maybe Huber. I'm not sure.
Uh-huh.
Hubert Witten.
Yeah.
1990, NBC.
She was replaced by, Daphne Reed?
Correct.
On Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Where she played Aunt Vivian.
Aunt Viv, yeah.
Yeah, correct. Well done. Back to Sarah. Santino Fontana, 2005 on the CW.
2005 on the CW.
Yep.
Hint.
The show is Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
I don't know.
Yeah, no one's ever submitted a canon from this time, and no one ever will.
Never will. Those were two actors that played Greg, and the answer we were looking for in particular was Skylar Astin. That was a tough one. Back to Brandon. Lisa Kudrow, 1993, NBC. She was replaced by another actress. I'll give you a little clue. This is one of those pilot replacements, so we never ever saw her on this show.
Oh, okay. I'm going to need the name of the show then.
All right. The show we're looking for, Frasier. What's the actress's name that replaced her on Frasier?
I've also never seen Frasier. So, despite being told
name?
I should.
No. Guesses?
Perry Gilpin.
Perry Gilpin played Roz is correct. All right, back to Tara.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a very different show.
No kidding.
Mirren Dungey, 2007, ABC.
She was replaced by Audra McDonald on Private Practice.
Correct. 2 points. Last question's coming around. Sarah D. Bunting. Lyman Ward, 1990, Fox. L-Y-M-A-N, Lyman.
Ward?
Yeah, I think that's Ferris Bueller's dad, if I recall correctly.
It is. You're correct.
1990. James Eckhouse.
What? That's amazing.
Oh!
He was the pilot Jim Walsh on Beverly Hills 90210.
That's a very different show.
Yeah,
it is.
That was an excellent stab in the dark, Sarah.
Fuck.
Thank you.
All right, last question for Brandon. Your actress is Alex Borstein. The show 2000 on the WB.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Is this Gilmore Girls? And was she... If this is Gilmore Girls, I'm going to be so angry.
I will let you know this is another pilot replacement, but did see this actor later in the series, but not in the role that she was replaced.
Wait. We see Alex Borstein in the series later, but not in the role that she was replaced.
Not in the role, correct.
Yeah. That could still be Gilmore Girls, though.
Who replaced her?
I guess. I wouldn't know because I never saw a pilot, and I've only seen episodes of Gilmore Girls out of order.
Okay, well, you know some of the actors' names, so take a step.
I'm gonna need the name of the show.
The name of the show is Gilmore Girls. You were correct.
Yay!
Okay, so here's where it gets a little bit iffy. I also don't know the name of any of the actors in Gilmore Girls. However,
there's a couple famous ones in there.
Yes, but not the person who I'm thinking of,
okay.
Which is who, unless she played Lorelai or Rory, I wouldn't know. But I think the person I'm thinking that she replaced as the in the pilot would have been the cook whose name is different. But I have no idea who the actress is, so I would need.
Boy, I want to give you that
You're
point.
You're really
so
triangulating
bad,
it.
So bad. You had everything but the actor's name there. You're correct on all points. That was the character Suki, played by Melissa McCarthy from Everything.
Oh my gosh, that is Melissa McCarthy, isn't it?
So I'm giving you half a point just because you had so much right there. All right, last question for Tara.
Yeah.
Genevieve Bugeaud, 1995, UPN.
UPN. Is this Kate Mulgrew on Voyager?
It is.
Wow.
She was the pilot
Janeway
in Voyager's later replaced. Final regulation scores, please, Tara.
And you resisted the Desmond Pfeiffer joke.
All right. We finished thusly. Brandon had, of course, 9.5 points.
Yep.
He got the half point from Dave for triangulating Melissa McCarthy. Sarah finished with 10 points. I finished with 17 points.
All right. Tara won. Before we crown Tara, let's just play this tiebreaker for a future steel meal.
Okay.
For whoever gets it. I have a bunch of actors that have succeeded in a character. I'll start reading them. Name the character whenever you think of it.
Okay.
William Hartnell.
Doctor Who.
That is correct. You saved me reading the other 20 names, so I will thank you for that.
Wait, who was it?
Doctor Who.
Tara.
Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We paid above asking for Lifetime's Ruthless Realtor before going around the dial with stops at Love in the Time of Corona, Below Deck Mediterranean, and Amazing Race. Doug could indeed bend the panel to his will to get Avatar's The Last Airbender's City of Walls and Secrets into the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was a winner of this week's Game Time from Corey. Next up, Lunch with the Bishop on Extra Extra Hot Great, and on the next EHG Prime, it's a trio of user suggestions from the Extra Extra Hot Great stable. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
leave the bastard.
Sarah D. Bunting.
He's a giant bison.
And Brandon.
Once again defeated by Gilmore Girls.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
I feel that.
We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Get out!
Listen to me. Listen to me. Okay. But I swear this is... I'm not making this up. I swear this is...
It sounds like BS.
It's not...